I want to invite you to reach for your handout as we look at this introduction to Proverbs, and I want to introduce this in a way that will help us to see that the book we're going to be studying is a book that is for every one of us. There's not one of us that are exempt from gaining insight from this book before us. However, we can stop gaining something if we're a certain kind of person that's also mentioned in this introduction. And because of that, I want to begin this all by quoting some poetry. And I'm not a poetry fan. I love reading. I love words. I'm a wordsmith. I enjoy putting words together in a way that's hopefully pleasing and clear and insightful. I love all of that about words, but I have never had a penchant for reading poetry. The reason I don't really delight in it is you have to slow down to enjoy poetry. You have to savor each word and allow the words to really shed light in new and nuanced ways. And I tend to want to read as fast as I can so that I can get as many books under my belt as possible. And that's why it's unusual for me to remember any poetry. But there are two lines of poetry that I remember. One's Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach, which has got some of the most beautiful words about life and living in this world that I've ever read. The other poem is a poem called The Rock by T.S. Eliot. That's written in 1934. T.S. Eliot wrote these words. You may have heard them before. They're well known. He writes, "Where is the life we've lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we've lost in information?" You can even hear as I read it. I want to read it fast. I'm going to read it slow again so you can savor it. Where's the life we've lost in living? Where's the wisdom we've lost in knowledge? Where's the knowledge we've lost in information? Eliot in 1934 laments the loss of life and of wisdom because in his mind, humankind was lost in a sea of information. Which is very surprising. This is 1934, written before computers, before the explosion of information technology, before the so-called information age, which we're in and since 1970 have been in. It's easy to say that his words would be even more applicable to us, and maybe he would have been more emphatic, because we live in an age where we have more information than we know what to do with. If you read one issue of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or whatever is your newspaper of choice, in just one issue, you will read more information than anyone previous to the 20th century would have had access to their entire life. They wouldn't have had access to all that's going on in the world and all the different ways of being and all the things that we are constantly deluged by. And we not only have papers, we have the internet, we have Google, we have wikis, we have e-readers, we have iPhones, we have Twitter, we have Instagram. On and on you can go. We live in a world awash with words. And in that clutter of news screens and newsprint, the real question is, what do we do with this? What do we do with this knowledge? We have more information than we ever have possessed at any other time in human history, but do we know how to use it? And that's what Eliot is lamenting. We have information. How can we use it? And of course, that's what wisdom is all about. Wisdom is about the wise use of knowledge. It's about taking the information we have before us, combining it with the seasoned information of sages that have gone before us, and trying to make sense of life, trying to live in an ordered, structured cosmos that God has created in such a way that we don't run against reality and it beats us in the face, but rather we align ourselves with reality as it is. Wisdom is not, and I emphasize not, about having a lot of information. We know people who have a lot of facts in their head. They could win every Trivial Pursuit. They could win at Jeopardy. But they don't have a lot of wisdom. We also know people who have a lot of wisdom that don't know all the current facts. They're not up on their Twitter accounts and their Instagrams and everything else that's coming at them, but they don't feel a need to because they've learned how to walk wisely and to use the information they have well. Eliot laments that we don't have insight, understanding, wisdom, because we have lost that in the sea of information. Because of that, his challenge remains ever true. The answer to his challenge is the book of Proverbs, I would like to suggest to you. At least it is the beginning of an answer, because our author in Proverbs wants to show us that there is a wisdom that comes from having the right mindset, the right way of coming at life, the right use of the knowledge available to us, and also including the knowledge of sages in the past. The author wants us to use that knowledge for our welfare and for the good of the community, for justice, for equity, and for all those things. And because of that, he gives this intro that allows us to understand three things: what the book is for, who the book is for, and how one takes that first step in the way of wisdom. So if you'd follow as we go here, verse 2, he wants to tell you right away, in two verses, the purpose of the book of Proverbs. These are for learning about wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for gaining instruction in wise dealing, righteousness, justice, and equity. That's what the book's for, to give us wisdom, to give us insight, which is the way of wisely reading a situation, using the knowledge we have to understand and not be naive, to not be deceived, but to use the information we have to read the situation well. But I particularly like those words in verse 3, that if we're wise, we will be righteous, we will pursue justice, will pursue equity, that the wise person will live within a created order in such a way that not only does their life flourish, but the lives of others around them flourish as well. So the purpose is all these wonderful words: wisdom, insight, justice, equity. Who could argue against that? This sounds great. But of course, one of the things that a naive beginner might think is, boy, you know, I'm not a Yoda yet. I'm not Gandalf. I'm not Dumbledore. Is this book for me? Is this something I won't understand? And right away our author wants to tell us this book is for everybody except for one type of person. So verse 4, it's to teach shrewdness to the simple. The word simple here means naive. It's inexperienced. It's someone who doesn't know the ropes at all. And right away we're told this book is for the naive, the gullible, the easily deceived, those who are untrained in any ways of wisdom. You got to start somewhere, and we all start as novices at the end of the day. And in order to get started down that path of wisdom, this book is there to help us realize this isn't beyond us. This is something that even the naive, the simple, can enter into. But then the author goes on and talks about a second category: knowledge and prudence to the young. Now the young here are not naive. They haven't just started. They're young. They're just beginning to grow in wisdom. And I love the words that are used there: knowledge and prudence. And as we go through the book of Proverbs, you're going to hear me use the word prudence again and again. A word that gets really undermined in our culture. A word that people see as antiquated and old-fashioned. You may remember the Saturday Night Live skit with Dana Carvey when he'd do his imitation of George Bush Sr., because George Bush was always talking about the prudent option, and he'd do his imitation and do his hands, and he'd say, that's not prudent, or that's prudent. And it, you know, we all had a chuckle because it sounds antiquated, it sounds old-fashioned. But what we must never forget is all the great philosophers of the past have said prudence is so important, it's actually one of the four cardinal virtues. To wisely make choices, to think about why you're making the choices you are, and to what end you're making those choices. Prudence is the opposite of being impulsive. The impulsive person with haste rushes into a situation not thinking it through, and it could turn out well by accident, but most likely it's going to really fall to pieces because you haven't thought through the situation. The prudent person thinks about what they're doing. The prudent person follows Socrates in "the unexamined life is not worth living." They examine, they think, they want to understand how I make decisions, why I make decisions, and to what end. So we have the naive in verse 4, and then the young, the amateur in verse 4. But then you also have a final category in verse 5. Let the wise also hear and gain learning. So, just in case you're one of those who thinks you're already wise, and I think that's probably a challenge in and of itself. Thomas Merton, one of my favorite, if not my favorite theologian of all time, certainly my favorite author, would say about anything to do with God and religion and spiritual life, we're all beginners. When you pray, pray as well as you can, because nobody is ever advanced in it. We're all always beginners. And in fact, it's arrogant to think we're anything but beginners. But there is a category of group of people that have walked with God, that have been seasoned in life, that have learned from their mistakes, that have got to the point where we, like the characters in our stories, look up to them like a Gandalf or like an Obi-Wan, and we understand these guys know how to use knowledge rightly. They understand how to take and filter out what is not important and to focus on what matters the most. And it's those mentors that we look to in life and we understand as the wise. So if you're in that category, and I would hope that we'd all aspire to that category, the book of Proverbs tells us, if you're wise, there's more to learn. Listen in. It's not the end. There's always room to grow. You can teach an old dog new tricks. If you're willing to be wise, you're always open. So we have the people this book is for. And you could take and modify a quote from our UCC that basically at the end of the day, everyone is welcome, wherever you are on life's journey. Naive, amateur, professional, seasoned, this is a book for you. Now, there's one person this book is not for. In order to see that person, we need to look at the final verse, verse 7, because the author wants to tell us the first and necessary step we must take in order to be wise according to the reality we find ourselves in. And that first step of wisdom is, verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Later in the book, it will read, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Which is a way of saying, in the ancient Hebrew way, that wisdom begins not by having great intellect, but it begins by having a right relationship. That there is a sense in which wisdom takes God seriously. And that's what fear of God is about. I've used this over and over because it's the most simple way I have of explaining it. So many people get off-put by the word fear of the Lord or the phrase. That's tragic because to be a God-fearer is a good thing. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We tend to do that because we only think of fear as terror instead of thinking it as wonder, as reverence, as astonishment. As understanding that we are dealing with someone or something beyond our control, so we better respect it or him or her. And that's what's going on here. So that the difference between one type of fear and another is, put as simply as I can, the difference between ah and ah. The ah of terror is what so many people hear, but that's not what is intended by the biblical authors. What they're trying to communicate is the ah of reverence, that God is taken seriously, that God is seen as the creator and we as humble, dependent creatures, that God is seen as the source and fount of all wisdom, and we are seen, when we do possess wisdom, as participating in the gift that God gives of wisdom. You could put it another way. If everything is dependent upon Yahweh, if all of creation comes from God, it's ordered by God, it's structured by God to a good and moral end, then the fear of the Lord is understanding that if everything is connected to God in some way and dependent upon God, then every facet of life has a religious dimension, and every choice I make must take into account the fact that God exists, and God has a law, and God has a will, and God has a desire, and God has a purpose. That every decision is factoring in reality, the whole of life, and not just our own self-interested perception. That's why there's one person that will not grow in wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and then the last phrase there, fools despise wisdom and instruction. Now you might think fool is very derogatory here, and in many senses it is, but Proverbs is all about, and wisdom in general, simplifying things. There's wisdom, there's foolishness. There's blessing, there's curse. There's righteousness, there's wickedness. There's life, there's death. Proverbs likes to simplify in order that we might get the point. And when we hear that the fool is not going to learn, what we understand is the fool is the opposite of wise. It doesn't mean that they lack intellectual ability. any more than it means in being wise that you are incredibly intelligent. You don't have to be incredibly intelligent to be wise. So that when we talk of the fool, what we are dealing with is not someone who's mentally deficient, but is self-sufficient and has ordered all life as if there is no God. Psalm 14, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And the issue is not between being an atheist and a theist. The issue is living your life as if God has no bearing on reality. It is to not take God seriously. It is to not even factor God into one's decisions. You could say it's apathy in relation to God and God's will, which is then to say that we are surrounded in a ship of fools with fools. Because there are a majority of people that live life without not one thought concerning what God might desire, what God might will, where God may be leading things, because that is not a factor in their thinking at all. The world is as it is, and they're trying to make the best of it, but they haven't thought about how the world is structured and ordered with a wise intended end. That God has made a world in which there is right and wrong, and there's an end toward which everything is proceeding. Now, I'm going to use an example here that's extreme, just so you can see that to be a fool is not necessarily to be unintelligent. You can be brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And I'm going to use an example, and I know my wife's going to hate this. I love you, honey, so just don't hurt me later. She'd never hurt me. Carl Sagan, brilliant, brilliant physicist. He certainly is more intelligent than I'll ever be if I had 10 lifetimes to live. But one of the things he was committed to is that there can be no hint or trace of God in the cosmos. That's the reason why he called his TV series Cosmos. Because he refused and actually despised any physicist which would use the language of creation. Because creation implies a creator. And so he wanted to use cosmos, and so his TV series always begins with the cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be, which is not science anymore, that's philosophy. You can't use the scientific method to prove that. That's total philosophy. The cosmos is all that is and was and ever will be. But he used the word cosmos intentionally because you can't say creation. You certainly can't say anything that implies that we're creatures. You have to speak of the fact that we are beings, and you have to use the word cosmos in order to take out any sense that God is involved or even a factor at all. What Sagan didn't realize, and you can't blame him for this, he wasn't a Greek scholar, the word cosmos in Greek means design and order. That's where we get the word cosmetologist. Your beautician, if you have one, obviously I don't, your beautician arranges and designs and orders your makeup and your hair so that you can look as beautiful as possible. Because that's what a cosmetologist does. Because cosmos in the Greek means that here's something that's structured and ordered and designed. So if creation implies a creator, cosmos implies a designer. And, you know, he wasn't aware of that. He attributed all this design to the law of physics, which I guess you could do that, but the laws of physics don't explain the existence of the laws of physics. We need a lawmaker. We need someone to make those laws. They don't explain themselves. All that is to say, here's a brilliant man, and here's this attempt to try to speak of all of reality as we know it, but it's a limiting of reality to just the material cosmos, where the biblical narrative wants to say something different. It wants to say there's an inherent design and order. The world makes sense from the perspective of wisdom. It's not a result of impersonal forces with no goal in mind. There's actually a structure and order. That's what Genesis 1 is about. The days and the order and the structure of the days of creation is not there to try to give an age of an earth. That's a stupid way to come at Genesis 1 and not the way it was ever intended to be read. But it's there to show us the wisdom. There's order, there's structure, there's environments, there's inhabitants, there's an order to this. And with every day, God says, good, 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 very good. So that this structure and order is moral. It's good. And this structure and order has a teleological goal. It's proceeding towards something. It's meant to lead to something. It's not just the result of chaos and impersonal forces. With that biblical understanding of the ancient Hebrew, that the world as we know it is ordered and structured morally, teleologically, by a God with purpose and a will, then you begin to realize what wisdom's about. Wisdom is the attempt to align ourselves with that structure and that order and that morality and that purpose. It's an attempt to find ourselves within God's orderly created world as God's creatures. Which is why wisdom is so emphatic in saying there's a right way to live and there's a wrong way to live. And the reason the wrong way is the wrong way is because reality doesn't adapt to your wishes or your whims. Reality is what you run into when you're wrong. And so when you take God out of the picture, you run into reality. When you take morality out of the picture, you run into reality. When you take a purpose or plan out of the picture, you run into reality. Now we live in a world that you have some who think that their mental perceptions create the world that is, or they assume that I can kind of redefine reality to fit my own whims. And the truth is, for those who have even a semblance of wisdom, is reality does not bend to our wishes. Reality is what it is, and wisdom is just simply saying, if God exists, if God is created, if God has created order and structure and put within God's creation a right and a wrong, a good and an evil, that there's a sense of order, and that which goes against the order is evil. It degenerates from that order. Then wisdom is simply trying to align oneself with reality. To align ourselves with the reality that is, with the God who is worthy of our reverence and our adoration and our astonishment, because we don't exist without God. We are not self-existent. We instead find ourselves saying, here's where we find ourselves. How do we align ourselves with the good God who's created a good world that's moral and orderly? That's the difference between the fool and the wise. The fool is not mentally deficient. They can be very intelligent. The wise person isn't always very intelligent, but they might know how to use the intelligence they have to walk wisely and well in the world God has created. In other words, they've learned, instead of letting reality run into them and knock them over, they've learned to try to find the way ahead by aligning themselves with God's reality. So that's our book, and that's what this intro is about. It wants to show us that this book is for good things. We all want wisdom, insight, justice, and equity. That this book is for everybody. Wherever you're at in life's journey, this is for you. But the only way to really begin and to learn from this book is to take a relationship with God seriously. And this is what distinguishes Proverbs from self-help literature. It's not about self-help. It's not just good advice isolated from a relationship with God. It's not merely about self-improvement. It's about allowing us to use the information we have to wisely walk in the world that God has created. It's not about intellectual achievement, but relational awareness. That's why the key verse to this book is Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, which I've put to memory long ago. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart. Lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. That's what wisdom's about. Not about intellectual achievement, figuring it all out for myself, but trust in this relationship, this fear of God, this taking God seriously. Trust in Yahweh with all thine heart. Lean not unto thine own understanding. The fool is wise in his own eyes, is one of the Proverbs. In all thy ways acknowledge him. Because if Yahweh is connected to all of life, then every decision in some way can be influenced by that relationship. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. I want to invite you to find the wisdom that leads to real life, to take the way of wisdom. That's what this whole summer series will be about. The call that we have is not just to be a saint, it's to be a sage. In whatever age we are at, whatever circumstance. And really, because I'm a Christian pastor, I have to take you one step further. And that's why that reading from Paul is there. At the end of the day, Paul wants to say in verse 3, our very last verse on your handout, Christ in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. If you want to see the perfect way of aligning oneself with reality, where God exists and God has created everything to an appointed end, you simply must watch Jesus in action. Because he is the true Obi-Wan Kenobi, the true Gandalf, the true, you know, all those other characters. He's the one that really does align himself. And in doing that, he's the very embodiment of wisdom. Later in that letter, Paul will say, in Christ all things hold together. That he is such a wise embodiment that you can literally see how in him all things hold together. The Gospel of John will say he's the Logos, the reason, the source, that which makes sense of everything, because you finally see someone walking in perfect fear of God, in true wisdom, living out a life of wisdom and righteousness and justice and equity as God has intended. And that's why Paul desperately, and if you read what he's saying again, look at the very first verse. It is Christ whom we preach. That Paul is committed that if he preaches Christ, then he's going to be preaching justice and wisdom and equity and order and purpose. Because he wants his people to be conformed to the likeness of Christ, who is himself the embodiment of wisdom. I want the same for myself and the same for you. Which brings us back in closing to our Eliot quote. We live in a world where wisdom can be lost in knowledge, where knowledge can be lost in information. But what we really want is a life worth living. And that life worth living is a life that proceeds from the wise use of knowledge. We'll be looking more at that in the days ahead. Would you pray with me?